All right, a little bit of news before we, and by the way, we've got Neil deGrasse Tyson here tonight, probably the world's premier astrophysicist. The world, actually. So anyway, a little news first. You know the big blimp, right? Everybody's seen it now, the one that drifted into Pennsylvania and then deflated into a tree. Well, the news is there is no news. In other words, they don't know what happened. I have my own theory. Remember when you were a kid and mom gave you a balloon and you held on to it? Mom said, don't let go. You held on to it and you held on to it. But finally, you couldn't stand it. You just let it go. Whee! Remember that? Well, I think probably some airman was sitting there bored to death, tired of seeing that thing in the same old place, and went, whee! I don't know. Anyway, that's the blimp, such as we don't know anything. So let's see, what do we know what happened today? Quite a bit, actually. The Senate marched Thursday toward a final vote on a two-year budget debt deal. It's not such a good deal, really, because the president can spend as much money as he wants. Maybe he'll spend a little on space. Ha, ha, ha. It's kind of scary, you know. We don't like the government shutting down, but it allows for virtually unlimited spending, and in the hands of the wrong person. Actually, that's the whole government we're talking about. The success or failure of the Syrian peace talks this week, fat chance, is tied to the fate of one man who's not even at the table, President Assad of Syria. So Iran, Saudi Arabia will be there at a table along with their powerful partners, Russia and the U.S., Again, I'm going to say this. I think the whole mess in Syria is the most dangerous damn thing anybody's ever seen in their life. It's a proxy war going on there. Russians are bombing the rebels who want to overthrow Assad, and the Russians don't want Assad overthrown. We probably have mixed feelings on Assad now, but we're bombing ISIS. And today also the Pentagon said, by the way, that it's going to be boots on the ground, actual combat in Iraq. Deja vu, right? All over again. I'm very worried about that. One mistake, and we sort of do a reset on the planet. China has now made the decision to abolish the one-child policy. Now, this may have to do with their lack of growth recently. Not lack of growth. The slowing of growth. So I guess if you can have two children, you have more productivity, question mark? You have to feed a lot more people, certainly. I wonder if they did it because of growth. Okay, so George Bush emerged from the third Republican debate in crisis. Supporters struggling to understand why they should keep giving him money. Trump, of course, said he was one of the winners. And one other item, tonight, XDS, we feed XDS, it's a satellite service, and they tell me that there may be a brief interruption at some point in the show, in which case they'll just put up a backup show for about 2 or 3 minutes, whatever happens. So if that happens to you, stations, blame AT&T. I know I blame them for mostly everything else. One last item, there was a 767 aircraft, another one in as many months, that caught on fire on the runway. It was not a pretty sight. Everybody got out, but there were about 15 injured. Some of those were actually pretty serious. So here we go again, engine fires. All right, stay right where you are. Coming up in a moment, Neil deGrasse Tyson will honor the show with his presence. I'm Art Bell from the middle of the desert, just adjacent to Area 51. You hear that, Neil? This is Midnight in the Desert. Coming up now, Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson was born and raised in New York City, where he was educated in the public school system, clear through graduation from Bronx High School of Science. Tyson went on to earn his B.A. in physics from Harvard and his Ph.D. in astrophysics from Columbia. Neil's professional research interests are very broad, but include star formation, exploding stars, dwarf galaxies, and the structure of the Milky Way. Neil is currently kicking off the second season of National Geographic Channel's Emmy-nominated Star Talk on Sunday, October 25th at 11 o'clock p.m. Eastern. Don't miss it. He also hosted Nova's Science Now and Cosmos, a space-time odyssey. Neil is the fifth head of the world-renowned Hayden Planetarium in New York City and the first occupant of its Frederick P. Rose directorship. He is also a research associate of the Department of Astrophysics at the American Museum of Natural History and the man who was at the very least an accessory to the premeditated murder of the once glorious planet Pluto. Welcome to the show.
Okay.
How you doing?
Second, where you are on the Pluto debate.
Nowhere, really. I just read that and I thought, cute.
Well, you antagonize well.
Yes, well, it is said. Since we have it as a subject, actually, I'm nowhere on the Pluto debate. I just thought it was cute. The question is, why did you think that Pluto should be demoted as it was?
Well, just to be clear, I got implicated. Going back now 15, 16 years, we were redesigning the Hayden Planetarium and the facility, the building that contained it. Mm. And in that redesign, we're creating an entire new modern astronomy museum. Huh. And in that museum, it's like, wow, we're cutting metal. And we want to cut metal. If we're going to cut metal, we want, you know, content of high shelf life. And so we looked at Pluto and said, you know, Pluto looks more like these new things that have just been discovered, these Kuiper belt icy bodies in the outer solar system. They look more like each other than either one of them looks like any of the other planets in the solar system. So all we did was group it with this new swath of this newly discovered real estate called the Kuiper belt. We didn't demote it. We didn't give it a new name. Mm-hmm. That all came from other people. But this got noticed, and people said, how come you didn't group it with the rest of the planets? You must be anti-Pluto. And that's when all the hate mail started coming in from primarily third graders.
Really, third graders. Yes, indeed. Well, it's
and
all over.
A few years later, an official vote would be taken by the International Astronomical Union, formally sort of demoting from its planet status to a dwarf planet, with new definitions of what that even means.
Well, it's all over the internet that you were part of that.
Yeah, I'll admit to like driving the getaway car, but you had to have been the one who discovered these other objects in the outer solar system, which forced the conversation. I was an accessory for sure, but not more than that.
Okay, all right. Well, let me now ask that we've had a good look at Pluto and the amazing geography on Pluto, and the fact that it's a little bigger than we thought it was. Have you reversed your position?
Oh, no. In fact, it remains true no matter what that it and these other objects are more alike than any of them are like the rest of the eight. So, and it was a little bit bigger, like by a few inches. You know, this is not like, oh, it's twice as big. No, it's like a little bit bigger.
Right.
And we were all delightfully surprised by how much how many surface features manifest in these high-resolution photos.
Yes.
That have no real explanation beyond something happening from within. Many people expected it to be sort of its surface to be a victim of collisions, so it'll be cratered perhaps, or you know, ice freezing and refreezing. But it's got like mountain ridges and valleys and so fascinating features that deserve much more attention than Pluto has gotten in the past.
Since we thought it was basically, I think, pretty much a billiard ball, and we've now found out what it really is, does that say to you one of two things? Either Pluto came and got captured from elsewhere, where it really was active, or it really has a lot going on internally.
Okay, so I'm not the best expert on Pluto compared with my colleagues who study it professionally, but I can tell you that Pluto has a large moon of its own, a moon called Charon, large relative to it.
Right.
And in fact, it has the largest moon relative to it as a host planet than any other planet in the solar system. Next comes Earth. Earth and its moon, we have a pretty big moon compared to us. And then on top of that, it's got like other moons in orbit. And it's hard to capture a rogue ball with all of its moons intact. It doesn't really work out that way dynamically.
Good point.
So unless there's some result I have yet to see, I don't know anyone who is thinking that this was just a captured object. And it works well just as having formed with everybody else. It orbits in the same direction around the sun as the rest of the the rest of the objects in the plane of the solar system. And so even though it's tipped pretty far out of, tipped nearly 30 degrees out of the plane of the solar system, one of the oddball features of Pluto that left people suspicious of its planetary allegiance, that going back 40 years, by the way. But so generally, if you're captured, it's you have an orbit that's more weird than even Pluto's orbit.
Sure. So that means internal heat, volcanic stuff, radiation, something.
Yeah, I mean, if you're going to make mountains, something's moving around on the surface of your object. And so, no, it remains a frontier. And the data are coming back slowly because to get the spacecraft to Pluto as quickly as we managed, my colleagues, managed to get it there, because the number one rule in all of science is you want your experiment to be finished before you die. So Pluto is really far away. So the way to accomplish this is you make the lightest possible space probe, and you put it on your most powerful engines. And this gives you very high acceleration away from Earth. In fact, it passed the orbit of the moon in like 9 hours, something of that order, whereas it took the astronauts 3 days to get to the moon. That's how fast this thing was moving.
Ooh, it was screaming.
So the reason why I'm dragging you through those details is that they could have given it multiple means of transmission and data taking and high bandwidth, but that would have cost weight, and then it would have taken much longer to arrive at its destination. So as it is, the transmission back to us and the data taking of Pluto itself happen through sort of the same channels within the electronics. And so it's a very slow going in the obtaining of the data from Pluto, and they'll continue to feed us for many, many months to come.
What's the baud rate coming back, do you know? Probably about...
I don't know the exact rate.
Low.
I don't know the... it's high enough to, you know, so you're not there forever, but the point is, it could not give us data simultaneously while it was flying by Pluto. So all of our knowledge of what it was doing was on sort of models of its trajectory and what we expected it should have been doing while we were not communicating with it, because it needed every bit of its electronics to obtain the data during that flyby. And there it is, traveling for 9 years, and then it's like a few hours in a flyby of Pluto before it emerges on the other side, headed for other destinations in the Kuiper Belt.
All right. Well, now I want to ask you about the really, really, really big story. I sort of broke this early on, not the first, I'm sure, but probably the first big one, was in the Washington Post. I'm talking about this star that has, and the headline was, serious scientists talking about an alien megastructure. I call it KIC 8462852, I believe. KIC seems like an easier
telescope,
name.
Yeah,
that's right. Kepler, of course, is now conveniently disabled for the moment, so we can't continue to look with Kepler. But what they did find caused one scientist to really, you know, open her eyes quickly, pass it on to scientist Jason Wright at Penn State, and he said the word aliens. I would think that before any scientist, any astrophysicist would utter that word, they would think about their career, their family, their life, everything ahead of them before they would even suggest that word. It is, though, a fascinating story, and I'd like your take on it.
Well, sure. So, no, you know, we all love the aliens. Don't get us wrong here. The issue is, if you come upon something that you do not understand, and you are a scientist.
Mm-hmm.
History of the exercise in coming upon things you don't understand tells us that, to echo a comment I first heard made by Carl Sagan, the most extraordinary explanation is not likely to be the most likely explanation.
Hmm.
This is a simple recounting of the things scientists have come upon that they did not understand in the past. And so for them in a press release to say, we don't know what it is, could be aliens. No, we don't know what it is. It could be a new kind of star system that we haven't studied yet. It could be a new kind of orbital dynamics that we haven't learned yet. I would go through a list of maybe 150 things personally before I would land on aliens as a possible explanation for it.
All right. I don't know if their list was that long, but they did say they virtually went through everything they could think of before they got to anywhere near that word. I guess the one standing item that still could be would be a comet swarm, they were suggesting, but the odds of that are very, very low.
Yeah, whatever those odds are, it is surely higher than it being an intelligent alien civilization. That's all I'm saying. And so you would invest just the history of this exercise. That's all I'm saying. You could spend your life as a scientist exploring the least statistically, when I say statistically likely, again, I'm basing it on the things that were mysteries in the past that got solved, okay? And we learned that they were not solved by aliens or new forces of nature or God or spirits, right? They were solved by known laws of physics in a new way that we had yet to explore. Given that track record, I'm simply saying that I would not lead with that explanation, and I would comets. I would like make sure I could rule out comets, and then, by the way, I would still say, you know, I just don't know what this is, and I would need better data before I'd start commenting that it might be intelligent aliens. Mm-hmm. By the way, I'm not faulting people for arriving at conclusions to interpret things you don't understand. We have an urge to need to have an answer to things. This is one of the greatest drivers of sort of religious text, because you go to your religious text because it has answers to things you don't know anything about, like what happens after you die and how did it all get here. And then you have an answer, and then there's comfort in having an answer. Whether or not you choose to investigate the answer to see if it's in fact held up by data, it doesn't matter. You have an answer. The most successful scientists are not the ones who invoke answers that have no supportive evidence in the face of ignorance.
Yeah.
They just say, I will pose more experiments until I have enough information to judge what it is I'm looking at or what it is I've tested.
Okay.
And that's what distinguishes successful scientists from not.
Well, I'll tell you this. It got everybody excited enough so that virtually every radio telescope on Earth right now is pointed at that, listening really closely.
Exactly, because we don't know what it is. Not because we think it's aliens. There's an important distinction there. We are perfectly content standing on the precipice of what is known, peering into the unknown and saying, I have no idea what's out there. And I have a hint that here's something in particular I don't know what it is. Let me design more experiments to find out. And then when I have something reliable, I'll report on it to you. You'll be the first to know. Or the second to know.
Okay, both are what 1,500 light years away, something like that, right?
I forgot how far away it is. But
pretty close, way out there. So every radio telescope now pointed in that direction. And I don't think we're going to get a discrete signal, you know, nothing in Morse code, nothing like that. But
well, keep in mind that the signal that was obtained, what Kepler telescope does, in case people haven't read up on it, it was a telescope. It's run its useful life now, by the way. It was conceived and designed for one purpose, to discover Earth-like planets around sun-like stars.
Right.
And so it had a target list, and it focused in one direction in the sky. And because planets are so dim relative to their host stars, the way this was going to measure it was to look for what we call transits of the planet across the surface of the sun, and which would require, of course, that the star system you're observing is edge-on to you. Because if we were face-on, then the planets wouldn't go in front of the star, and then you would see nothing,
right.
Nothing to notice.
Sure.
So if it passes in front of the star, and you're monitoring the intensity of the light carefully, you will see the light dip ever so slightly, because the planet is blocking out some of that light. And then the dip comes back up,
right.
As the planet moves off the sun's surface from transiting across. And then if you see this repeat, then you have things like the size of the planet, you have the orbital time,
sure.
You can deduce a lot of information. And the Kepler telescope produced a catalog, released a catalog of 1,800 planet candidates. And by the way, there's more data in the pipeline still to come. But those are the ones that were like secure enough to actually put out a press release on. And in there is this one object that has this peculiar eclipsing pattern, this peculiar darkening of the star relative to all the other planets that have been discovered and any expectation we would have for what's going on around it. And we discover new stuff all the time in the universe. And for that reason, I think astronomers are some of the more humble among professions who are out there, because we are dumbfounded all the time. We discover black holes. Who ordered that? The expanding universe. Who ordered that?
Right.
Dark matter, dark energy.
We'll get to all of those, but you've got to admit, 22% occlusion is just incredible. I mean, 10%, 12%, 22%.
It's a mystery.
It's a good
of mysteries.
One. I mean, Venus would only dim it by what, 1%?
Yeah. It's 1/100th, less than that. It would dim it by, less than 1%. That's correct.
So something big is going on.
Yeah, but like 0.1% Venus would dim this our sun by if somebody else were looking at it from afar. That's right. So it's some huge thing. We don't know what it is. So it's cool. And by the way, anytime there's something that we don't know what it is, like you just noted, people bring all the armament to bear on it, every possible telescope. Even if you had a different observing plan set up for it, you will turn the telescope in that direction. And because we have more powerful telescopes on Earth than what Kepler was. Kepler is basically a discovery telescope, right? And so it's tuned for this one specific purpose. You take the big hammers down here on Earth and focus on that star. Now you have a pre-selected star where you know something interesting is already happening.
All right. And Doctor, so if the radio telescopes come up with nothing more than a rise in noise floor as they're aimed at this star system, would that raise your curiosity level another notch? I mean, I don't imagine a single signal, but I do imagine the possibility of an industrial alien society using a lot of electromagnetic stuff.
So let's go there. So that's a good hypothesis. So let's back up to the Kepler telescope, however, and let me just affirm for you that it was only using visible light. And that's how it noticed that the light of the host star dimmed.
Gotcha.
So now, if it is an alien, if it is something that we don't understand but could be have some intelligence, and if it has some intelligence, and it would also have to have technology, because presumably we counted ourselves as intelligent as a species long before we had technology, right? So it would have to have intelligence as we know it and technology. Technology communicating with itself, with others, then there'd be radio signals. So you take our largest radio telescopes, aim it at this,
right.
And look to see if your radio signal goes up,
right.
Whether or not you can interpret it.
That's right.
Like you said, it could be the floor, the noise level goes up. That means some even though you don't know what it is and can't decode it, some extra stuff is happening there. And you compare the noise level to the noise level you'd expect just for the native emissions of the star, because you don't want to read something that is natural to what you already know it would be emitting. So it'd have to be above all of that. Then that would be interesting. Then, by the way, that could be just some new radio phenomenon, and that alone would not presume that it has intelligent aliens with technology.
No, I said raise the interest.
Kind of radio source.
Yeah, raise the interest level by a notch is what I said.
It would definitely. That's the right way to say it. It would further raise the interest level. Now, if you take the radio telescopes and point it there, and there's no increase or blip going on. By the way, you'd have to do this at many frequencies. All right, it's not like let's just listen.
Oh, they're going to many.
Yeah, of course. You spread it out, and if nothing's there, then we bring optical telescopes back to bear on it to see if we can try to get an image of it.
All right.
Use interferometry.
Doctor?
All the other secondary means.
Hold on for a sec. We're at a break point. It's the long one. Enjoy it. We'll be back.
Dark Matter Network News. This is Amy Martin. A Saudi blogger, Raif Badawi, convicted of insulting Islam, is expected to receive the second 50 lashes of a 1,000-lash sentence soon, according to reports. The lashings are to be carried out 50 at a time for 20 weeks in a row. According to The Atlantic, the 30-year-old founder of the website Liberal Saudi Network, which was dedicated to fostering open discussion of religion and politics in Saudi Arabia, was just awarded the Sakharov Human Rights Award by the EU Parliament. His sentence and punishment has been condemned by many prominent political figures, including several foreign governmental and UN leaders and 8 U.S. senators. Also, according to The Atlantic, flogging as a means of punishment is prohibited under the Convention Against Torture, an international treaty to which Saudi Arabia is party. The kingdom is also member to the UN Human Rights Council, where it heads an influential panel. A plane has caught fire on a runway in Fort Lauderdale Thursday, just prior to takeoff. More than 100 passengers had to quickly evacuate the Boeing 747 using emergency slides. One person was seriously injured during the incident. Evolution may happen faster than we'd previously expected. A new study of chickens could overturn the popular assumption that evolution is only visible over a long time scale. For a long time, scientists have believed that the rate of change in the mitochondrial genome was never faster than about 2% per million years. The identification of these mutations shows that the rate of evolution in this pedigree is in fact 15 times faster. NASA's New Horizons spacecraft has successfully completed the third in a series of four maneuvers, propelling it toward an encounter with the ancient Kuiper Belt object 2014 MU69, a billion miles farther from the Sun than Pluto. The targeting maneuver, performed with the spacecraft's hydrazine-fueled thrusters, started at approximately 1:15 p.m. on Wednesday. It lasted for about 30 minutes, surpassing the October 25th propulsive maneuver as the largest ever conducted by New Horizons. The four maneuvers are scheduled to alter New Horizons' path to send it toward a close encounter with MU69 on January 1st, 2019. The flyby would be part of an extended mission that NASA still must approve. Based on its brightness and distance, MU69 is estimated to have a diameter of only 20 to 30 miles, with an orbital period of about 293 years. New Horizons is currently located about 122 billion miles past Pluto. Just imagine how far it will have to travel over the next 3 years to reach its next targeted flyby. This has been Amy Martin for Dark Matter Network News.
This night, with the presence of Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson. And, John, I guess my pre-show notes just can't be right. Judging from what I've heard, I mean, it says here that he was prepared to come on tonight, completely reverse his position on the frequent transit in our atmosphere of UFOs. So, I guess I was wrong about that. Doctor?
Hey.
Hey.
So you're putting words in my mouth? Is that what you're doing?
No, I'm kidding. I know that you're not a real UFO kind of guy. So,
well, I don't know that I have a position on anything. I just, you know, if I'm just thinking that if they were to visit us, it wouldn't require somebody's eyewitness testimony. You'd have way better evidence than that, and so. Want to keep looking for them, go ahead. I'm not going to stop you. But I have judged what people seem to be so low a likelihood of them being real as to not trigger any interest in me at all.
Mm.
But I'm glad some people are, because one day you'll find one, and then you won't need – no one will have to believe what you say, because you'll be walking down the street towing a flying saucer for everyone to investigate, and then we're done. And then you were right all along, but now you have actual material evidence for
it. If I get to actually tow a UFO, then probably
no.
I'm going to claim
be a little one. Okay.
The better technology.
But Maybe somebody's truck. We got trucks towing all kinds of stuff. I bet we can find one. My favorite scene in the movie Independence Day was when the alien sort of crashes in the desert and Will Smith pops the hatch, punches the alien in the face, and says, "Welcome to Earth."
You know, actually, I think that's about what would happen in real life. Let's say
I think it's so too.
Yeah, if something landed, the door opens, the ramp comes down, the little green guy starts down the ramp. He would be so full of lead before he got to the bottom of that
exactly.
ramp that he'd be rolling.
100 million guns in the United States would greet him first. Then we'll hand him over to the military.
Yeah, that's right, I'm afraid.
Yep.
All right. Let's move on to other things. So much while we quite have not left alien life, the big question, is it your view that somewhere out there, almost unquestionably, there is life?
Well, the way you have to approach that is not saying yes or no. You have to sort of assess likelihoods. And so
how about probably?
Yeah. So you look at I would say likely.
Likely.
That there's life. Yeah, that there's life elsewhere in our galaxy, certainly the universe. But I'm not basing that on wishful thinking, right? You base it on an analysis, on what I would think is a sensible analysis of how long the universe has been around, how many stars there are, now the likely and better determined number of planets that would exist around those stars, and how long did it take life to start on Earth? Actually, it started pretty quickly, within a couple of hundred million years of when it could have possibly have started.
Right.
By the way, it's not that life took 800 million years from like 4.6 billion to 3.8 billion, all right, or 3.7 billion. No. Because the first half a billion years on Earth, we were still being heavily bombarded by the accretion of the leftover things in the solar system that were basically still making the planets.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not fair to begin the stopwatch then. Wait until that cools off. Now you can make complex molecules, because under high temperatures, complex molecules don't form. So start when you can. Now you start the stopwatch, and then 200 million years later, we have simple life, but self-replicating life. And then, yes, it would take another 300 million years before you had complex life, but life itself happened pretty quickly. And the ingredients on Earth are the same as the ingredients practically everywhere in the solar system. Carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, hydrogen. These are some of the most common ingredients of the universe. If we were made of something rare, you might have an argument. Like, I joke about this, an isotope of bismuth. If life on Earth were based on that, then you say, hey, we got something good going here on Earth. Nobody else has got this. Or they can't possibly have it in large numbers. But we're made of the most common ingredients, like it or not. And so, given these factors, it is easy to think that life, even at possibly as we know it, could have formed in countless places across the galaxy and the universe. And now you want to ask about intelligence. That's like another level. And, of course, who are we to even say that we are intelligent? Because we invented the test to decide who's intelligent and who isn't. And humans win that list, and no other creature does. So the hubris of that, for me, is laughable. But given even accepting that, it's not clear that intelligence is inevitable, because if the asteroid never took out the dinosaurs, our mammal ancestors would still be there, having not evolved into something more ambitious than themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And because the dinosaurs were around on Earth for longer before the dinosaur hit than the time that has elapsed since then. Now, this is a profound fact, because it argues strongly that were it not for the dinosaur, the asteroid, the dinosaurs would just simply still be here. And we'd be running for cover under their feet the way rats and mice run for cover under our feet. And so that would be an Earth without intelligence, but teeming with life.
You don't think that other ecological changes would have taken them out eventually?
They were going for hundreds of millions of years. What's another 65 million, which is the time that has elapsed since they've been extinct?
True.
65 million is small compared to how long. So they don't, now, by the way, we use the word dinosaur, but that refers to many, many species, some of which came and others went. Okay, not all the dinosaurs you see in the cartoons or in any authoritative source were all alive at the same time, right? So I say dinosaur as just this dominant lizard, reptilian thing on Earth. But T-Rex surely would have had his run and then maybe gone extinct, but other dinosaurs would have risen up, as had happened over the hundreds of millions of years that preceded it. But there's no indication that these big-brained mammals derived from tree rodents of the day would have evolved to anything more ambitious than what they were at the time.
Dinosaurs originally, I guess, were, or birds of today are descendants of them, right? Some birds?
Yeah, they're a branch of what we would think of as, and I learned all this, I work at the American Museum of Natural History, which has an entire department of vertebrate paleontology. That's how much the study of life goes on in the museum, that they can separate life forms that have vertebrates from life forms that don't, and they're two different departments
right. In
the museum. So vertebrate paleontologists, these are the dinosaur hunters. And I learned from them. I didn't know before I've been at the job for 20 years, but being near them sensitizes me to all these things that they know and that they study, including the fact that birds are direct descendants of dinosaurs. But colloquially, when we say dinosaur, no one is thinking bird. We're thinking T-Rex. We're thinking the dinosaur formerly known as Brontosaurus, you know, the classical dinosaurs that you see in movies.
Okay, let's change to the large before we do that, I actually heard you on another podcast, Joe Rogan. Really, really got a kick out of the talk you had about, you know, people who think that the world is going to end. September was a very interesting month because I talked to a lot of these people. And there were at least three separate, when the first date came, I can't remember what it was now, and the world didn't end, they were kind of upset and set a second date. That passed. They set a third date. That too passed. I haven't heard from them since. They're probably warming up for something new. But the world should have ended in September, according to all these folks. My God, I got a lot of email about that.
Well, so what I find fascinating, and somebody should study it, if not psychologists or cultural anthropologists, somebody should study the fact that there are communities of people who are predicting the end of the world and then are upset when the world does not end.
What is that about?
They'd be happy that they were wrong.
Yeah, what's that about? Why would they be upset?
I don't know. This is what I'm saying. Somebody's got to study it and figure out what's going on in the human mind, in the human brain, where there are people who are only happy when they're sad.
Apparently so, yes. Well, you're right about that. They kind of slunk away, you know.
And there's a great website. You can Google it for ends of the world. And it is an endless list of predictions made for the end of the world that go back thousands of years. And it gives, and not all of them give a date. They say, oh, sometime in the next 10 years or so, 10 years goes by, and it makes a note that the world has not ended yet. But what's interesting to me about the end of world scenarios is whoever is telling it to you, it is very likely, I would say a certainty, that they're telling you the world will end in our lifetime. And this, and if you become a believer of that, then you end up joining the movement, and then they become the head of a movement. Whereas if they say, oh, the world is definitely going to end in 150 years, no one's interested, nobody cares.
That's right.
It's less potent an argument to give to grow the cult or whatever it is you're creating for yourself.
But there are people not in cults who follow this. I mean, millions of them, literally. It's amazing to me. So I thought that was a good discussion. Anyway, on to the Large Hadron Collider. That's news right now. They're powering it up to apparently a power they've never reached before, with two things in mind. One, possibly it's said or it's rumored to create a mini black hole, and or two, to connect with another dimension. What can you say about this?
Yeah, so I mean, my specialty is astrophysics, not particle physics, but I can tell you what I do know from I have a lot of friends who are particle physicists. So first of all, just keep as background information that when modern physics makes discoveries, typically, it's because an experiment has been designed that enters a regime of energy or force or pressure or some measurable quantity that had never been reached before.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not fundamentally different as a goal from the astrophysicist saying, I want to now have the biggest telescope there ever was, because that will enable me to see dimmer things than ever before and farther than ever before. And anytime you push such a frontier, you are bound to make some kind of a discovery, because you're entering what we call a parameter space never before explored. So with the Large Hadron Collider, with this new round, if you will, they'll reach higher energies with that, as you'd expect every next time they do this. Once you refine the operations of it, they got the Higgs boson out of the way, so now let's keep going. So now mini black holes, these are fascinating things because they're not particularly stable. And they evaporate essentially instantly by Hawking radiation. They just evaporate.
Higgs boson evaporated pretty much right away too, right?
What? Say again?
Higgs boson pretty much evaporated.
We wouldn't say in that case we wouldn't say evaporate. You can decay to another particle or another kind of. But a black hole. I mean, we literally there are particles that were inside the event horizon that now emerge from outside the event horizon in the space around the black hole, and then the black hole loses mass. And then and this continues until the black hole loses mass entirely, and then it disappears forever.
Mm.
So if it makes black holes, there'll be tiny black holes, and they'll be of no real they might be fun to study, but they're of no danger or consequence.
So there's no danger they'll create a black hole, and it'll just not disappear. See, that'd be problematic.
You mean if it just decided to eat everything?
Yeah, starting with the collider, I'm sure.
Yeah, back when they first flicked this on the switch of the collider, there was a YouTube clip of like the security camera of the parking lot outside of the CERN facility, and it had a countdown clock near it, and seconds till turn on. So it turns it on, and then this hole opens up in the parking lot. All the cars fall in.
Really?
You know, people, creative videographers, you know, especially when inspired by science catastrophe, makes for some entertaining viewing. There is no risk of that. And by the way, your concern is healthy, but unfounded. What I mean by healthy is one should always ask, what is the risk? Could this happen? Could this possibly be? And if you look at the history of these kinds of experiments, everybody's worst nightmare was never realized. And because the worst nightmares that people came up with were not based on the reality of the calculations that were actually done. And so, we'll just look for more discoveries of things. And I don't even know what next particle they're looking for. Maybe next time we talk, I can come in with a portfolio of what remains to be discovered.
But, something smaller than Higgs. I know that, smaller than Higgs.
Exactly. Well, consider that there are three kinds of discovery. There's, I think something will be there, and I'll look for it, and lo and behold, I find it. And that gives credence to my hypotheses that I put forth to begin the experiment. But another one is, it should be there, and I look, and it's not there. That's almost as interesting, maybe more interesting, than finding what you're looking for. It's not finding what you're looking for. And then a third one is, you find stuff that you never even dreamt should be there.
Mm.
And these are three fascinating outcomes.
Or how about this one? Something happens that you weren't prepared for.
Yes, that can happen at any time. Yes.
Yes, well, that's the one everybody worries about. And I'm not saying it's going to happen, but if you were to ask a scientist at CERN, what is the risk of something catastrophic occurring, how would they answer, do you think?
Yeah, I don't know, but that's a great let me think of a way to pose that question slightly differently. So it would be, are you prepared for something to happen that you're not prepared to happen? I mean, that's kind of what you're asking.
It is.
And I guess by definition, the answer is no. By definition. However, you can quantify some of those risks. For example, at a baseball game, there's a ball thrown 90 miles an hour.
Right.
There's a bat swung at 90 miles an hour. And if any of those gets loose, it can fly into the stands and hurt you. So you say, watch out for the possibility of these flying into the stands and hurting you.
Hmm.
And you can ask, what would a rotating bat going, you know, 90 miles an hour do to the human body?
And
you can calculate this and figure this out.
Sure.
And so even if it never happened, of course it has happened, but even if it never happened, you can judge what kinds of things can go wrong based on what you know you do on the baseball field, or based on what you know you do in a particle accelerator. There's a limit to how much energy can possibly leak out because you know how much energy you're putting in. You don't get energy from nothing. So you can contain your concerns in some way, but I have to concede at some limit, if you've never can anticipate it, something could happen that you've never anticipated.
Well, in a major league ballpark, you can put up a fence. And so you probably limit the, you know, your liability when somebody gets whacked because they're not going to get whacked.
Exactly. Yes. But yeah, so maybe my example wasn't as good as it could have been.
So I'm not sure putting a fence up around CERN is going to cut it.
Well, the Mets are in the World Series, so I have to mention a baseball.
No, that's fine.
But yeah, fence, that would be interesting. Yeah, it would keep the baseballs out of CERN, but that's about it.
Keep the nutcases out, maybe. So this is about to happen, I guess, within the next few days, or it's happening now. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't remember when the next phase is, but it's soon.
It's very close. Mm-hmm. Black holes are really interesting.
Oh, by the way, I got to tell you, we would have had something 3 or 4 times more powerful than this had the budget not been cut to zero by Congress in 1993. We were building the superconducting supercollider in Texas.
I know.
Not many states are large enough to have contained the size of this circle, of this particle.
They actually started digging.
They even had a hole dug.
That's right.
Correct.
That's right.
And you can read the reports, and they say, oh, well, budget overruns, and we have to conserve and all this. And I have a different interpretation of what happened. That it's very simple. That in 1989, peace broke out because any previous budgets that funded particle accelerators got funded.
Uh-huh.
Because people knew in the 20th century that physics mattered. A physicist is an expert in matter, motion, and energy. And what is war if not the simple transfer of energy here to energy there?
And money from here to money.
Really good at.
Yeah.
And when you're at war, Cold War, of course, that was, money is flowing like rivers.
Dr. Tyson, we're at a break.
Justify it.
You're absolutely. This is what I want to talk about when we get back. Not only as it relates to the Hadron Collider or the collider that could have been in Texas, but I want to talk about the space program. I am so sad about our space program. We'll be right back. This is Midnight in the Desert. Probably the nation's absolute premier astrophysicist, probably so in the world. And you're not going to want to miss his Star Talk on Sunday, October 25th at 11 p.m. Eastern Time. That's going to be quite a show. Now, I want to jump because I want to talk a little bit about when I was 13 years old, I got my ham license. Then I went into radio. I was deeply into electronics. I loved and still love electronics. I'll be a ham till the day I die, more ways than one. And it was a wonderful, wonderful time to grow up. I grew up watching the space program. I grew up watching man stand on the moon. I grew up seeing all of that, and it's all, I don't want to say it's all gone, but I don't know. The spirit that America had, what we were looking to the future the way we did, it's just not the same. Dr. Tyson, would you care to comment on that?
Sure. So what distinguished the 1960s from all times that followed it, and of course, the 1960s ended in like 1972, 73, I guess with the end of the Vietnam War and when we stopped going to the moon.
Yes.
And of course, the 60s began when the Beatles you know, appeared on Ed Sullivan. So that's the operational definition of the 1960s. And so in the 60s, every single space mission was more ambitious than the previous one.
Oh, yes.
Because there was a goal set that had not yet been reached. And so Gemini had two astronauts and not one. And each Gemini mission was testing spacewalking and docking and maneuvers that you would need to execute in order to go to the moon. When the last Gemini spacecraft was retired, there was the Apollo spacecraft waiting in the adjacent launch pad, ready to start its rounds of tests. And culminating in, of course, the landing on the moon with the Apollo 11 in July 1969. When you look at modern times, where people are getting excited about the space shuttle or the space station, you're advancing a technological frontier to build a space station the size of a football field orbiting the Earth.
Mm-hmm.
No doubt about it. But for my money, you're not actually advancing a space frontier. What you're doing is you're boldly going where hundreds have gone before, into low Earth orbit. And so that's why people are asserting that, oh, well, space is just not interesting. Well, it's not interesting because there's not an advancing frontier to garner the headlines, such as what happened in the 1960s.
Nor do they seem willing to admit how many things came out of the space program that we take for granted now.
Yeah, that's a whole other conversation.
It is.
Perhaps the most under-heralded aspect of the space program was the need to miniaturize electronics mm-hmm. to save on the weight of the launch vehicles. And so every functioning piece of electronics, from the computers to the communication devices, everything, a lot of engineering brain work went into make them small. And the act of doing so then led Earth people to say, hey, this radio that used to be a piece of furniture in my grandparents' living room, maybe I can fit that on my hip. Clearly, no one in the 1920s was looking at the radio saying, I want to carry that around with me,
right,
and one day I will. No one knows how to have that thought, because that's not the mindset at the time. So much of what we count as modern access to computing and electronics as being portable are traceable to the trend that was initiated by NASA simply to go into space. And that's not simply a patent. It's not a spin-off in any literal sense. It is a trend in what you needed to do to get the job done.
Right.
And what impact that had on the innovation of everybody else here on Earth.
So, what's happened to us? In other words, why can't this case be successfully made to those who hold the purse strings for whatever we want to do?
Well, so I wrote a whole book on this. It was called Space Chronicles, Facing the Ultimate Frontier. And by the way, that book was the title I submitted it with to the publisher was not that title. The title I submitted it with was Failure to Launch, the Dreams and Delusions of Space Enthusiasts. And the sales team said, oh, we can't sell a book that has the word failure in it. That's bad. And I had a whole argument with them that I lost. Okay, so here's the thing. Many of us who remember the space program, we will recount it as being the deeds of you know, the deeds of explorers. It's in our DNA, perhaps not only as a species, but as Americans. Look what we did.
Yes.
And there's a lot of that going around. But consider, we were at war. We were at war with a sworn enemy.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, almost every single metric of success in space, we did not win. The Soviets won. They had the first satellite. They had the first non-human animal. They had the first human. They had the first woman. They had the first black person. They had the first space station. They invented the rocket equation that tells us how to actually design rockets to have them launch to go to our destinations. What we did, and they didn't do, we landed on the moon. So we did this one thing and then we say, we win. But in fact...
Yes, and they now virtually hold the keys to the space station. They're the only ones who can get us up there.
They're the only one. And I used to say that we hitch a ride with them, but in fact, no, we're paying tens of millions of dollars per seat just to get to the to get to the space station. So it leads you to wonder, do we need to be at war in order to stimulate a moving frontier in space? Because that, there is no question that that's what stimulated it the first time. And I joke about this. I imagine visiting China and going visit the head of China and whispering in his ear and saying, I just want you to leak a memo. It doesn't have to be true. Just leak a memo that says you want to put military bases on Mars. And then we would design, fund, build a spacecraft, and launch it. We'd be on Mars in 10 months.
Wonderful.
For sure. And so...
No, that's good. I'd rather not have to go to war to achieve it. But you know what? Right now, if you look at what's going on in the world with Russia and Syria and the proxy wars and all the rest of this baloney, China with their islands, us with sailing by them, we're getting closer to the old Cold War by the minute.
Yeah, that's a scary prospect because things are not becoming less tense. They're becoming, it appears, more tense. And with us putting our warships near the Chinese islands that they're building, in that same article that I read of this was when I learned that the Chinese had put one of their warships off the coast of Alaska when President Obama was visiting Alaska. So it's like tit for tat kind of war games going on. And so I don't know what the long-term future of that is. But maybe the only thing that'll keep us safe is that everybody, you know, everybody's in debt to everybody else.
Well, there is that. I guess if we got into a tiff with China, we would suddenly just say, all right, we're keeping our money.
Right, right. And they don't want that. And so maybe it's the economies that are preventing it. But I have another plan. I don't want to call it a plan, an idea, I'd rather say.
Okay.
And that is for a nation to grow economically and to maintain a sense of security and health and wealth, it will require innovations. We know this. Innovations in STEM fields, the science, technology, engineering, and math fields. These are the engines of tomorrow's economies. We've known this since the Industrial Revolution and before. So with this, we can pose the question, what is the greatest driver of innovations? And what we have today are people saying, I know what we have to do. Let's create programs that gets kids interested in STEM fields. That'll fix everything. No, it's not. You know why? Because adults outnumber kids 5-1, and adults vote, and adults wield resources and funding, and adults are in charge. And if you have scientifically illiterate adults, I'm not waiting around 30 years for the eighth grader to become president and then solve these problems. There's an adult problem, an adult science illiteracy problem that is in the way. So what I would suggest. Is if the government says we are going to go into space in a big way, then it becomes highly visible, as going to the moon was highly visible. And the government said we're going to put people on Mars, and you know who those astronauts will be? They're in middle school today. Let's select the Mars astronauts today, and it'll be a 50 middle school students from across the country. And Team Beat will follow them. And we're all going to want to know, are they eating their, you know, their 3 square meals? Yes. Are they getting good grades? And we would grow up with them. And they would be the first pioneers to Mars. And to do that, you're going to have to innovate in countless ways to get people to Mars safely and have them return. Plus, we're going to have to use materials on Mars if we're going to spend any time there, unless you send cargo ships in advance. But all of this has never been done before, which means you're going to have to innovate. And that will turn a sleepy nation, a sleepy country into an innovation nation. And when you're an innovation nation, that you know that there's something cool about innovating. You'd have the same attitude towards innovation that Elon Musk has.
Oh,
and
yes.
He wouldn't sit there isolated as a lone genius trying to solve all of our problems, because we'd all be part of that same solution path. So I see space as a force operating on our urges to be innovative, whether or not you are actively engaged in aerospace fields, and that would be transformative of our nation.
If you were in charge, if you were in charge of NASA, and you had lots of money, and you could set the agenda for our next big goal, what would it be?
So it's a great question. So I'm going to give you an unorthodox answer first, and
sure.
then the longer real answer. My unorthodox answer is, I don't want to be head of NASA because the head of NASA reports to the president,
mm-hmm.
and but we as citizens, the president reports to us, and so the real power is not in who's head of an agency. The real power is in the electorate. So if the electorate understands the value of this, then they would only elect into office the people who resonate with that valuation. And then you don't have to run to NASA wouldn't have to run to Washington every 2 years with hat in hand saying, please top up my budget. Those folks would already be in place.
Well, I've been watching these silly debates, and not once have I heard a question about space.
Precisely, or science even. Forget, but science or technology.
Indeed.
As though this is some optional thing that maybe we'll get to if we have time, when there is no health, wealth, or security without it. So I am astonished that it has not only not been addressed directly by the candidates, the journalists are not going there either. Maybe they think that science is not going to sell in the debate ratings. I don't know. But it's a travesty if we're going to have debates where science is not the theme. It's at least one of the topics of the debates.
Thank you.
Because somebody's got to recognize that there is no modern society as we have come to build it without the contributions of science and technology to it. That's all there. That's pure and simple. Now,
okay. Well, here's another mystery you can try and explain. While there is not much interest among the public, or maybe that's wrong. There is. While there's not much money getting poured into it, if any at all, look at Hollywood. That's all they're doing. Did you see The Martian? Great movie, actually.
I think Hollywood is a litmus test for what the appetite that exists for people to want to think about space, to go into space,
yes.
to dream of tomorrow. And the great thing about The Martian was science and technology were themselves characters
yes.
in that film. My favorite thing to say about The Martian was they had the cliched scene that any astronaut movie is going to have, where one of the astronauts is looking at a video screen of their spouse and their child.
That's right.
See, when you're coming home, and they touch the screen. When they did that in this film, I'm thinking, could you hurry that up, please? I want to see if the experiment's going to work. And that's normally the most touching scene in any of these other films, and this one kind of got in the way
yeah.
because the science and technology was where all the suspense was.
It
and
was
the
great.
Action and the so now to answer your question, what I think we should do. And I would offer this to people, and they can decide for themselves. I don't start movements. I'm not hitting people over the head. I want people to vote freely according to what their own thoughts are, provided they're informed thoughts. So I'm going to give you some information. My sense is that if you set the next goal as a destination, such as Mars, you might get stuck with the moon problem. What was that? It was, we're going to the moon. And then we got to the moon, and then NASA was not designed to do anything else, because so much money got pumped in to make that one result happen, that the rest of the solar system laid untouched because it all got focused in a singular goal. What I would suggest is don't even make Mars a singular goal. You say, let us create a suite of launch vehicles that have the capacity, depending on combinations of sort of strap-on boosters, you can go to any destination you want.
Ooh, I like that.
When we built the interstate system for the United States, they didn't say, well, let's just connect L.A. and New York. No, let's build the roads everywhere, because I don't know in advance how creative people want to be in this part of the country versus another. So let us enable all transportation. So if you can do this, then sure, there'll be scientists who want to go to Mars and look for life. There could be miners who want to extract mineral resources from asteroids.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe robots will do that first, or people. We might want to put a telescope at one of the Lagrangian points on the other side of the moon.
Yes.
Tourist jaunts to the far side of the moon. And then all of the solar system becomes our backyard. And you're going to have to innovate to make all of that happen. And then once those frontiers are touched and the routines are established, then you cede that to private industry, which then makes a buck off of it. And then the solar system becomes our intellectual and vacation playground.
Well, listen, Hollywood's still all aglow with it. And as an example, the Martian drew in hundreds of millions of dollars. It did very well. That indicates the American public is still very, very interested. So it's just like a lack of a goal. We don't have a goal. Oh, and that interstate system you talked about, we've got potholes in it. Potholes.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's the infrastructure, that's a whole other conversation, of course.
Sort of.
I don't know what country this is sometimes when I look around. I'm old enough, maybe as are you, to remember in elementary school they would show these film loops of other countries, you know, and it would be like, you know, the United Nations Week or something.
Right.
And you'd see these like third world countries, as they were known back then, where, you know, oxen drawing plows driven by people,
right,
flies were on their faces, the roads were washed out. And we had a certain smugness about us. We're Americans, they need our help. And then here in the 21st century, the economy tanks, New Orleans floods, bridges collapse,
yes,
trains collide. And I look at this, what country is this? We don't have the tallest buildings anymore. Well, who would have thought that our planes would be flying slower today than at any time throughout the 1960s. I was expecting that today we would have like suborbital flight. You get to Japan in 45 minutes. But no. We used to have the longest tunnels and the longest bridges. And for a while, as a kid, I thought, well, this is just kind of like a peeing contest, you know, of what good is that? And then I realized that if you build the tallest building, you have to innovate to do that because you're doing what no one has done before.
Exactly.
So patents will be awarded. And so the very act of the very audacity of wanting to extend a technological feat, yes, there's pride and some ego involved, but at the end of the day, some new discoveries are made that in essentially every case apply to the rest of society in ways that move our culture and our nation forward.
Okay. Well, I don't think that the decaying infrastructure and our apparent non-interest in space are different. I think it's all wrapped up together. Something
in a malaise.
In a malaise, yes, indeed, a malaise. And we're not fixing things. We're not building things bigger, as you point out. Something has happened to us, and perhaps you ought to be in the business of starting a movement of some kind. I don't know what that would be, but
no. But then I would, you know, I as an educator, I'd rather educate people and occasionally enlighten them so that what the country does is what the electorate wants to do. I don't want to drag people. I don't want to you'll not see me hitting politicians over the head, no matter what they say, because they're representing an electorate. So if they say something, and even if it's like scientifically illiterate and they're gaining votes, that means they're being supported by people who resonate with that science illiteracy. And so as an educator, it's my duty, I think, to alert people of things they might not have known that they should know before they make judgments, before they formulate opinions, before they vote. And then if after I tell them what I think they need to know and they still want to vote for the person, fine. It's a free democracy. That's how it's supposed to work. But I fear that many people are simply unaware of what perhaps they need to know to make informed decisions about this, the 21st century.
I wouldn't even, if somebody said, well, okay, who do I vote for? So I get exploration, I get money to NASA, we begin moving ahead. There ain't no such candidate. See, that's
you know what came closest to that candidate was Newt Gingrich back in, was it 08?
Oh, the moon stuff. Moon.
Yeah, he was talking, and people made fun of him. And I'm thinking, and I'm not, you know, I know him. We've met a few times. But I wouldn't count myself among his great supporters or anything. So nonetheless, he says, let's have moon bases. People mock him for that. And I can tell you that given the state of technology, for him to suggest moon bases is not as crazy as President Kennedy saying, let's walk on the moon at a time when we had no spaceship at all. Think about what how big a step that was for Kennedy to say, listen, let's put a man on the moon before the decade is out. Not as big a step as saying, let's put moon bases on the moon now that we already have a space program.
All right, question for you. Are moon bases actually sustainable? Could we do it? Is it just a matter of money?
No, so moon bases, you'd have to, it's an outpost, so you'd have
yes.
to, you need a supply chain. You're not going to grow anything on the moon.
That's what I meant.
Create, so to have, you have HAB modules, right?
Yeah.
You have to do what Matt Damon did on Mars. But you're not really living on the moon. You're living on Earth on the moon, right? You're
sure.
creating a 72-degree habitat with a farm inside. And I would question why you might do that. It seems to be much more fun to just have a quick vacation there and then come back, not try to just live there. I mean, I don't see the point of making that your permanent residence, since it is supremely hostile to human physiology to step outside.
Because it is immediately so, yes. It would be doable, but the question is why?
Yeah, I would say, well, I mean, definitely have an outpost. Like we have outposts on Antarctica. There are no permanent residents of Antarctica, for example. And by the way, Antarctica is balmier and wetter than Mars. And I don't see people lined up to, you know, live in condominiums in Antarctica. So the same challenge would apply to Mars. You'd have to terraform Mars to make it someplace you want to go hang out. And I don't have a problem with that, which is nowhere near. You know, we can't predict next week's weather, much less terraform an entire planet and turn it into Earth. So we're a long way. I don't know how long, you know, 100 centuries away, perhaps. Don't know, but...
We better find somewhere to live. The way things are going right now, we may need it.
Well, so that's a common argument that, in fact, Stephen Hawking, you're in good company. Stephen Hawking made a similar argument, as did Elon Musk, that we want to be a multi-planet species in case there's some catastrophe, an asteroid or a virus or nanobots take over. And on the surface, that sounds good, and it makes good newspaper copy and clickbait on the Internet. However, if you have the resources, if you have the geoengineering power to terraform Mars, turning it into Earth, then it seems to me that you have the power to deflect an asteroid from hitting Earth in the first place. People say, we're trashing Earth, we need another planet. If you have enough resources to terraform another planet into Earth, you can terraform Earth back into Earth.
That's true.
So I don't agree with the practicality of making humans a double planet species. Because whatever that effort is, it's got to be less to permanently inoculate ourselves from any bad virus, whatever effort that takes. That's got to be easier than shipping a billion people to Mars. Mm. That's all I'm saying.
Do you worry at all about the possible ramifications of nanotechnology? I've thought a lot about that.
So a couple of things. So you have a way for your brain to enter that conversation. Your ability to build things or to manipulate things or to invent things, that is to create objects, mm-hmm. are intimately linked to the size of the tools you're using. So if you are constructing an office building, you're not using tweezers and a microscope. You're using right. bulldozers. So the size of the tools are commensurate with the size of the project. So now you have a surgeon operating on your eye. So now the tools have to be small, or on your brain. They have to be even smaller. So now, when you think of nanotechnology, possibly making robots or machines the size of, let's say, human cells, you need tools as small as human cells to make these things.
That's right.
Or you exploit biological molecular... activity so that it makes a sort of you deputize molecules in the service of your machines in some way that has not yet been achieved. That'd be the merging of biology and technology. But my point is, if you want to go there, you have to have tools that size. And if you have tools that size, oh my gosh, you could manipulate viruses.
Oh, yes.
You could. Yeah, I mean, that's an extraordinary frontier. And, of course, there's a dangerous side.
Oh, yes.
There's a dangerous side when we invented knives, right? You can kill people or you can kill your food. So So I'm not saying there aren't hazards, and I'm not saying that we should not have a growth of moral turpitude. Is that the right word, turpitude? Fortitude to accompany such discoveries. But when I pause and reflect on the power we would have over our genome, right, over our medicines, and how much that could help the human species, I'm not even thinking about what bad it can do. You'd set up laws and say, thou shalt not do these bad things with this technology. Mm. And of course, there'll be bad people who will. You find them and arrest them and put them in jail. Just as there are bad people who will stab you with a knife or shoot you with a gun, you take them and put them in jail. All right. So we'll need laws to grow up alongside it. But there is no doubt that so many of the things that we fall victim to, it's simply because we don't have the tools and the knowledge of how to use such tools, even if we did have them, commensurate with the size of the actual phenomenon going on that we would want to manipulate.
There's just been one big change in the world, Doctor, since what you're talking about now, and that is, back then, we could depend on mutual assured destruction. You know, somebody pushed the wrong button. Now, we have people in the world whose the center of their ideology is to bring upon us Armageddon, to start the war of wars that will essentially end everything. So if something gets in their hand that would accomplish that, they don't mind dying. They're ready to give up their life to end it all.
You're right. That was a game changer. And for us stateside, that all changed, of course, on September 11th, where at any minute before September 11th, we would have said to ourselves, yes, negotiate with the terrorists. Maybe we will survive.
Yeah.
As long as nobody's surviving, all bets are off.
All right. Good. Hold it right there. Good long break. 7 minutes, and we'll be back.
Dark Matter Network News. This is Amy Martin.
The United States House of Representatives has selected their new speaker, Republican Paul Ryan, Thursday morning. The 54th Speaker of the House won in a 236-432 vote, with Democrat Nancy Pelosi trailing at 184 votes. An intergalactic mystery has puzzled scientists since Voyager 1 passed into interstellar space in mid-2012. A strange magnetic field was observed, something inconsistent with what we'd imagined to see, even leading some to doubt that Voyager had even made it through the heliopause, or that outer edge of our heliosphere, which is like a bubble around our solar system where solar winds slow and begin to cease. Adding to the mystery, researchers have found that the magnetic field direction observed by Voyager deviated by an angle of more than 40 degrees from what was expected. But what could account for these odd magnetic readings as Voyager left our solar system? A recent study shows that the initial direction of the magnetic field observed by Voyager is deflected by the heliopause, like an elastic cord wrapped around a beach ball. Therefore, the spacecraft is moving through a special region of space where magnetic fields are rotated away from true magnetic north. This means that while Voyager 1 did cross through the heliopause in 2012, it is still traveling through this muddied magnetic field region and won't reach the pristine region of interstellar space until at least 2025. With this recent discovery, scientists now know they'll need to wait at least another decade before Voyager enters the region of interstellar space that is beyond the reach of the sun. Since the dawn of the space age, humankind has never passed through and explored this far-flung, pristine environment. We'll soon be able to answer further questions about the nature of cosmic rays and magnetic fields, as well as probe many long-standing mysteries of deep space. A new study suggests that researchers have achieved the most realistic robotic implementation of human walking dynamics that has ever been done, which may ultimately allow human-like versatility and performance. This work opens the door for robots to be more fully integrated into our daily lives. Mimicking human gait, responsible for balance and walking, has been a problem plaguing robotics researchers for decades. A new system, based on a concept called spring mass walking, combines passive dynamics of mechanical systems with computer controls. It provides the ability for robots to blindly react to rough terrain, maintain balance, retain an efficiency of motion, and essentially walk like humans do. This new technology also holds promise for biomedical applications. Have a strange story or a news tip? Email Amy
at artbell.com. This has been Amy Martin for Dark Matter Network News.
Just to finish up on my thought, in the old days, we were worried about the Russians. They were worried about us. We all knew what would happen if some idiot pushed the button. Today, I somehow imagine, I guess, some guy named Mohammed dressed probably in classy black ISIS attire with a little test tube full of something called gray goo. And, you know, there wouldn't even be a discussion about whether it's a good idea to let it loose or not. They'd just let it loose. Be that quick. So that's what I was talking about, Dr. Tyson. It is verifiably a different world.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things we need to think of as modern civilization is that if we are going to respect people's belief systems, that's what you would defend in a free society, of course.
Of course.
It's one of the things that distinguished the United States from so many other countries that came before it or have come since. So the difference, however, is that belief systems are not founded in objective truths. They're founded in personal truths. So it's your personal truth if Jesus is your savior, or if Muhammad is your person who is responsible for your spiritual fulfillment.
Sure.
And you go around the world and people have their personal truths. But when it is time to establish governance in a pluralistic society, you cannot create laws based on personal truths if you plan on those laws to govern everyone. So you need to take a step back and say, what are the objective truths that we know about in this world? Well, we have methods and tools to establish objective truth. It's called science. And I've been quoted as saying this, I said, I think once on Bill Maher, that the good thing about science is that it's true whether or not you believe it. So it's something that it applies to everyone.
Right.
You base your laws and your nations and your legislation on that, and that then can protect the freedom you would have to have whatever belief system you want. If you have an entire community of people who do not care if they remain alive,
right,
because they want you to have their belief system, that is a destabilizing force, not only in a nation, but in civilization itself.
Sure is. Sure is. And they wouldn't hesitate for a moment if they had something like that. They wouldn't even have a discussion about whether it was ethical or not, or a good idea, or suicide. They are ready to become martyrs to bring upon the end of the world. And so they would do it. Hopefully, nobody
yeah,
who
could, is,
yeah, go ahead.
You know what I wonder is if this is more hopeful thinking here. If that kind of attitude and that kind of state of mind is actually incompatible with wielding weapons of the power to actually affect that kind of outcome, because you have to know how the laws of physics work. You'd have to, you want to blow up the world, you have to have to study to learn how to do that. At some point, maybe you'll question the role of your personal beliefs in inflicting it upon other people, no matter what your personal beliefs are, or taking it, or trying to. It's one thing to convince people because they, you know, you preach to them. It's another thing to bring them on by force. And by the way, many of the successful religions over the years accomplish their success by just such activities,
mm-hmm.
Right? We can speak of peaceful Christians today, but there were whole episodes where that was not the case,
as
we all know. And so there was we're talking about modern society and post Dark Ages modern society, and for that to function as we would hope as civilized people, then something's got to give. At some point.
Yeah, something will give, all right.
So that we can move forward.
Well, as Lenin said, if you could make it so, would there be no religion? I know, that's a gotcha question.
I'm a fan of a free society. You can think whatever you want. Just don't require that other people think it as well. Then you've made a dictatorship. and it's no longer a free society that our founding fathers had imagined for us. So I don't run around chasing people and their religion. It's not what I do, and it's a, it, that would be a violation of the freedoms guaranteed all of us in the Constitution. It's the freedom to your freedom of speech, and what goes with that is your freedom of thought.
Mm-hmm.
You have that, whatever you want. But for example, if let's say you have a cult that is afraid of the number 13,
uh-huh.
Okay, what is it? Trixodecaphobia. Fine, fine. Okay, go ahead. But don't be tasked with designing elevator banks and leaving out the 13th floor of office buildings.
They do.
That shouldn't be your job if that is what you're afraid of.
Yes, indeed.
So.
All right, so here's something I'm sure you can warm up to. You are combining pop culture and science in this new TV show, Star Talk, right? I would... Yes, this is what you were talking about earlier, an effort to get people involved. And if it takes pop culture to ease them into science, so be it.
Yeah, I think of it, yes. So, but I think of it in a slightly nuanced, different way.
Okay.
And that is, I realized over the years that I was doing something that I didn't even know I was doing. Until I look back and I say, wow, that's what I was doing. And now I can say, like, I've known it all along, but really I had to even discover this in myself. What I realized is that if you take science and embed it in pop culture, then it is a ready-made vessel for people to embrace the science.
Right.
Because people already know pop culture. That's the definition of pop culture. For example, two weekends ago, I finished watching a movie, and I had a half hour before my next TV show I was watching, and I said, I would just start a channel surfing, as any, you know, red-blooded couch American does.
Yeah.
I'm channel surfing, and I stumble on the Cincinnati Bengals going into overtime with the Seattle Seahawks. And I said, perfect, I got 30 minutes, it's a 15-minute overtime, it's something good is going to happen.
Sure.
Something interesting, suspenseful is going to happen. So after the first round of exchange possessions, the Cincinnati Bengals comes in a position of a winning field goal kick. So there it is, it's hiked, the ball goes 42 yards as it tumbles through the air in this long arching trajectory, and it hits the left upright and then deflects into the goalposts for the winning kick.
Uh-huh.
Cincinnati Bengals win by 3. And I looked at that and I said, oh, I got to tweet this. So I get on Twitter and I say, okay, the winning field goal overtime kick by the Cincinnati Bengals was likely enabled by a third of an inch drift due to the rotation of the Earth. And people, like, blew people's minds. People say, oh, my gosh, I didn't. Now, here's the thing. I didn't have to explain what football was. I didn't have to explain a field goal kick or overtime or who the Cincinnati Bengals were. Not everyone is football fluent, but enough people are for that tweet to matter to them. And it got picked up by the sports networks, and everybody was talking about it. And it was no effort for me. I just happened to know what these deflections are. I mean, I did the calculation some time ago, and I just carried it forward into this moment. So in Star Talk, the more I can find ways to embed science in pop culture, I think the more accessible it is to people without dumbing it down. I'm not dumbing anything down.
Right.
I'm telling you like it is.
Sure you are.
Right? Yeah, and so that's the subtle difference. It's not that I'm trying to use it to soften it. I'm using pop culture as this moving vessel that's already coming through your living room. And then the science is for the taking. And that's what it has been. And Star Talk is the television embodiment of that. And, of course, it's based on a radio show of the same name that posts 50 times a year. But National Geographic Channel has sort of plucked their 10 favorite guests each season, and that they get lifted up and jump species onto television.
That's amazing. Well, maybe, you know, that's just you walking your walk, the one you talk about. And I hope it works. I hope it succeeds. What's the response like?
It's been very warm. In fact, the first season this past spring got an Emmy nomination, and I was very flattered by that. It meant that we didn't win, but we got noticed. And, you know, Emmy, you win an Emmy because people in the television professional community vote for it, right? It's a peered award in a sense.
Right.
It's not a committee. It's not some someone up on high. So the fact that it got noticed told me that maybe when you combine the fact of how well Cosmos did appearing on Fox,
sure,
not on, you know, not in the science ghetto channels of the upper dial, but Fox on Sunday night where everybody's home already, when you look at the success of Cosmos and the fact that I had, I mean, I, every morning I wake up and I look, do I have how many Twitter followers? 4.6 million Twitter followers.
That's
and
a
I
lot.
Said, that, do, should I remind these people that I'm an astrophysicist so they can still pull out if they need to? and look at the success of, it's not just me, look at the success of the Big Bang Theory television show. It's the number one show on television in any genre. It's pulling down $330,000 per 30-second commercial. This is,
incredible.
And these are, though they be caricatures, their banter is legitimate science unfolding right before our eyes. And look, and we said earlier in the broadcast, look at the success of The Martian and Interstellar and Gravity. And you have a biopic on an astrophysicist called Stephen Hawking where the lead actor wins the Academy Award. A biopic on Alan Turing with marquee actor Benedict Cabbage Patch, what's the guy's name?
Well, my point is all of this should somehow translate, you know, into the American people demanding that their the people who represent them start looking again at science, at space, at things
That's
that
a completely
we, yes.
rational thought. And I'm thinking, maybe delusionally, that the demographic who knows that are people who are 35 and under. These are the people who grew up with the iPhone and smartphones, and they know what value technology is to them, and they don't want to live without it. And these are the people who didn't necessarily become scientists, but they took science in high school and maybe even in college, and they liked it, and they want more of it, and they want to consume it in one way or another. And so that is the community, in fact, who grew up with Bill Nye, the science guy, in
mm-hmm.
their classroom.
Right.
And so it's a different approach to science than what an older generation had seen or experienced. And this demographic, however, is not yet old enough to run the country, right? They're just coming into the age of, you know, none of them are on boards yet, or but some of them actually are self-made entrepreneur billionaires, right? And they see that. They're one of them. Right? How old is Elon Musk? You know, how old could he possibly be? Or the founder of Twitter or Facebook or of any of these other sort of moguls, really. They all come from that demographic. And they know it's technologically driven. So however delusional I am, I'm thinking that as they move up in the ranks, oh, by the way, they also lead the country in support for social causes, in the sense that if you ask who is a fan, who is a do you object to same-sex marriage? Okay,
mm-hmm.
the objection fraction is like 10% or 15% for the 35 and under, and it's like 80% for 65 and over.
Right,
right. So there's a definite social trend, as well as a scientific technological trend. And look at how many people go to Comic-Con. Have you been to, maybe you've been to, surely you've been to San Diego during Comic-Con. You can't even believe it. Hundreds of thousands of people show up there.
Yep.
And it was surely began as just a small illustrators conference, you know, decades ago. Now look at what it is. It, by the way, I've said this before. I have this fear that we have actually been visited by aliens, but they happened to land in San Diego during Comic-Con and nobody noticed.
That's a puzzle. All right. So when I asked about the reaction to Star Talk, it wasn't so much about the awards, though I'm very, very pleased that you came to, close to getting it. What I meant is, are you getting a lot of emails, I hope, from young people inspired by it?
Yes. Yes. There are people, and of course, good news for you as well as others, the fact that people spend time in cars and in fitness centers and other places, the audio medium has previously, I think, was given up for dead a few years back has risen, the growth of podcasts and ways that people obtain information today may be primarily through just the audio medium. And so there are many people who say, I listen to you on my drive, and I listen to you on my on the treadmill, because each of these shows that go to National Geographic Channel also airs as an audio podcast, and on Sirius XM radio as well.
It's so, roaring back, Doctor. Remember the old days when you'd see a kid going down the street with a transistor radio plastered to his ear? Okay, today they're plastered to hips and pocketbooks, and they're called iPhones and Androids.
Yes, exactly, exactly. With a Bluetooth headphone connection,
that's
you don't
it.
Even see the device anymore.
That's right.
So, yeah, there's no end of communication on this. And by the way, just in case people haven't seen or heard an episode, just if I can spend 15 seconds describing the structure.
Go for
I'm
it.
I'm the host, and I'm a scientist, and my guests are hardly ever scientists. They are hewn from pop culture. And my conversation with them orbits, if I may use the word, all the ways that science has influenced their lives or their livelihood. And that way, their fan base gets to see them in just such a conversation. So I'd like to think that Star Talk not only attracts people who know they like science, it also attracts people who don't know that they like science, or better yet, people who know that they don't like science. And these people, how would you ever get science to them if they didn't simply follow their people wherever they went as a fan of who happens to be my guest? And then the way I make this work is I have a comedian who is a professional stand-up comedian as my co-host, and they provide levity when necessary. And then I bring in, if necessary, an academic expert, because not all the topics I talk about are astrophysics. It could be neuroscience, or it could be philosophy, whatever. I bring in an academic expert, and they provide a sort of a gravity valve. So I have a levity valve and a gravity valve. And I, as host, I adjust those valves so that I can hit a consistent delivery of humor, of pop culture, of science, in what I'd like to think of as a tapestry that gets woven during the show, so that at the end of the show, you now have a cozy blanket to cuddle with.
Well, it's apparently working, and that's why I asked you about the emails. Hopefully, you're firing people up. We need it. If we don't start pretty soon, I don't know. There could be a sort of a break point where if we don't begin educating people, if people don't dive into math, if they don't become entranced in science, with science rather, it may become too late, and we may not have enough to lead any longer, if we're even leading now. I'm not so sure about that.
You put the nail on the head there, because having led is not a guarantee that you will continue to lead. And, you know, I think we got kind of lazy. We got complacent and lazy because we basically led the world in every metric of scientific and technological advance in the second half of the 20th century. Yes, we were behind the Russians in those checkpoints, but by and large, if you look at the strength of our economy and other factors, it was America's century. And the way we're going, it is so not going to be our century going forward. And if we don't embrace this in just the recitation you gave, in the way that you described it, then some other country will. And, you know, science and technology does not have nationality branded on it. It exists to be discovered in nature, and if we don't do it, somebody else will. And if that's the case, we will dance to the tune that they play.
You bet. Hold on, Doctor. One last question, then I've got a million people want to talk to you. With respect to the Large Collider, I did ask you about the possibility of a miniature black hole, as well as one that could eat us all. But I did not ask you about the possibility of either opening or discovering or communicating with another dimension.
Yes, you did ask, and we got distracted by the black holes.
Right.
So there are suggestions that the manifestation of particles in higher dimensions has certain testable, measurable implications in our own dimension. And so So this is how you can actually propose a scientific test for something that you know is not within your reach, because maybe the thing that's not in your reach has indirect consequences for things that are in your reach. Hmm. And so, yeah, there's some hypotheses that the higher dimensionality, which we think we live in, you know, 10, 11 dimensional space that you've surely heard about,
sure.
But from others on this show, that, you know, we only experience our three spatial dimensions and one time dimension. But in the realm of a particle accelerator, you're extending beyond what your life experiences are.
Mm-hmm.
And so to the extent that higher dimensions exist and manifest in our own, there could be some experiments to test for that. And so that would be a fascinating space moving forward.
Mm-hmm. Do you think other dimensions are likely?
I don't see why not. I mean, why should the universe stop at the number of dimensions that we sense? Right? Why are our senses the measure of anything other than just our ability to survive on the plains of Africa and not get eaten by a lion?
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, that's really what our senses are tuned for. They're not tuned to decode the operations of the universe outside of those regimes. And this is where the methods and tools of science get invoked to do so. And that's why the universe has no obligation to make sense to us, because the definition of making sense is that it happens in our life experience. Outside of that, it just is what the measurements show it to be. And then you have to, so for some people, it's uncomfortable, or they want to stand in denial of it. When I say the whole universe was once the size of an atom, they say, no, that can't be so. That doesn't make sense. Precisely.
All right. Well,
it doesn't matter.
Yes, like with the miniature black hole, it would be an amazing discovery, of course, but should we do that and connect with another dimension in any way at all? Possible danger?
You know, I've been reading about higher dimensions ever since I was a kid, and it's some of the most fascinating, mind-expanding thoughts you can have.
Oh, yes.
Is imagining a cube in four dimensions, in five dimensions, and, you know, how many sides would it have? What would the sides look like? Just as a square has four sides that are lines, a cube has six sides that are squares. And a hypercube has eight sides that are cubes. And now this is where your mind starts blowing, because, like, what does that even mean? But I'm just following a mathematical sequence here. And so it is possible to formulate what the behavior of things would be in higher dimensions, because you can see the trend line going into them from one, two, and three dimensions that we're familiar with.
Right.
But that doesn't mean they'll be easy to understand, and they might even be impossible to understand. That's why the mathematics matters. And so to access another dimension, if we could, that would just be kind of cool, I would think. I mean, I see all this as amazing frontiers, not as something to fear.
Perhaps another dimension. Do you think it might be detectable by gravity?
Well, so gravity is a fascinating force because,
yes,
in fact, it has, I don't want to call it the power, but it has the properties of where it can emanate from our manifold, from our universe, and be felt by adjacent universes to us. So if there's a multiverse, the different universes can, in principle, feel each other's gravity, but significantly weaker.
Right.
But they can, and this is, would be a way to know the presence of a parallel universe without actually venturing there, which could possibly be quite dangerous for you if the laws of physics are slightly different. And your body will collapse into a pile of goo because the intermolecular forces are different, and they can't maintain the molecules that make up you. So, yeah, I will not be the first one to voyage into such a universe. But given the fact that gravity, as we know it and understand it, can penetrate those membranes, whereas other forces cannot, that's a fascinating fact that I think deserves much, much further exploration.
Boy, it sure is. You know, given a choice, if a scientist has put in, I don't know, a decade's work on some project, and he's got an on button and an off button, and the on button is going to initiate the experiment, whatever it would be, He might sit there for a few moments thinking about the possible implications, side effects of pushing the on button. But in the end, he's going to push it, right?
Yes, for sure. Now, consider that rarely is that experiment so out there that it would completely transform all of life and civilization as we know it.
Uh-huh.
What is more typical is that there's some other experiment that someone had done, and this person says, I think I can make that a little better, or a little faster, or a little cheaper, or a little stronger.
Yes.
And so then they build an increment on that, and then they push the button. And so generally this button pushing is going on as this person, one person steps on the shoulders of someone who came before them. They rarely, if ever, have a brand new thing out of the box that no one knows anything about, and they push the button and the world ends.
Okay, well, I'm going to be watching the parking lot at CERN.
Okay.
All right, here.
We'll find it on, I'm sure it's still on YouTube. Find it's really cute.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Here's Sean for Dr. Tyson. Hi.
Hello.
Hello, Sean.
Hey, Aaron. How's it going?
Fine.
Hey.
So,
hey.
It's an honor to be talking to you, Dr. Tyson.
Oh, thank you. No, don't even. I was just here to share knowledge.
So I have two questions. First one's just a yes or no question. Is there going to be a second season of Cosmos?
Oh, thanks for asking. So Seth MacFarlane, as you may know, was a co-executive producer of the Cosmos, which is part of how it landed on Fox, because he's, in a sense, a Fox property with his Family Guy and,
yes,
and his other projects. So he and Andrian, who was the co-writer of Cosmos, not only this one but the original one with Carl Sagan, they're both working to get this thing in motion and greenlit. And I don't have the latest from them, but they're working hard to make that happen. So, and at different dinners that we've had over the past months, different parts of the band have gotten back together. So we'll see. But it's likely to happen, but I don't want to I don't want to jinx anything, but let me just say that people are working hard to make it happen. But thanks for that question. So
my second question is
just yes or no.
What your best guess is as to what happened before the Big Bang?
My best guess, based on cogent ideas that are emerging from, you know, cosmologists, is that, you know, we're one bubble in a multiverse, and the multiverse would be the entity that we're not familiar with in thinking about and interpreting. But if you have a multiverse that is birthing universes and that come in and out of existence, we're just one of them. And so our whole world, our whole sense of the world, begins when our bubble started expanding. But if you go back to before the bubble, there's this multiverse there. Now, here's something that may force you to lose some sleep, is our experience tells us that the universe hardly ever makes anything in ones. Right? We thought maybe Earth was special. No, it's one of eight or more planets. How about the sun? Hey, no, it's one of, like, you know, 400 billion stars in our galaxy. Well, the galaxy. No, there's 50 billion galaxies in the universe. Well, the universe. Well, maybe there's a multiverse. Well, how about the multiverse?
Professor, I've got a question for you.
What's that?
Who blew the bubble?
How does the bubble begin?
Yeah.
Well, we're still trying to understand the multiverse, but we finished the point that maybe there's some other kind of entity that is comprised of multiple multiverses.
Hmm.
That is an interesting. I mean, that's
it is,
you know, turtles all the way down.
Yes,
is an interesting question here, and so we don't. It is a frontier to pose and answer the question, what was around before the Big Bang, or how did it begin? That's we have top people working on that, and so we just don't know.
We're close, aren't we?
Who blew the bubble? We don't know. And who implies that it is a who?
Well, that was a cute way.
Of course. But you have to be careful how you word a question.
I know.
Because it could bias an answer into a place that you're hopelessly looking for an answer. Like asking, what kind of cheese is the moon made out of?
Mm-hmm.
Well, if that's your question, then your answers and the experiments you devise will fail because it's not made of any kind of cheese. So, yeah, I knew you were having fun with it, but it has a serious response.
Okay. All right, let's go outside the U.S. to Raymond, wherever he is. Raymond, where are you?
Hi, Ray. I'm in Scotland.
Scotland, okay. You have a question?
Yeah, my question was, how long do you think it'll take man to actually land on Mars?
Huh?
Yeah, no, well, yeah. You know, that is such a good question that has possibly no real answer to it. You know, I can tell you this, that if we find oil on Mars, we'll be there really soon. So it's, I don't think, and this is my candid read of human behavior, I don't think it is enough motivation for any of our species,
right,
to spend the money to get to Mars to just say it is our destiny or it is the next frontier. That kind of talk hardly ever comes along with the money necessary to make it happen. The money that gets spent is almost always driven by the desire to make more money, the desire to protect your security, or, well, that's it, kind of. And in the old days, you would do it for kings and queens and gods. Nowadays, those are diminished forces in making things happen.
So, in other words, we need an economic reason or a war.
My read of history tells me that. And I wish it were not so. But that's, and nobody wants a war, so I presume. And so it means an economic reason. Now, does it mean finding oil on Mars? No, there are other ways you can construct an economic reason, as I hinted to earlier, where you just do it, and then the whole country, the world sees, wow, this is a cool thing to do. I want to discover as well. I want to explore. I want to innovate. And then everybody becomes an innovator in no matter what they do. And that would transform an economy. It'll transform a culture. And you'll turn the world into the world we all thought we'd be living in.
All right.
The tomorrow that never came. That's what we'd be living in.
Indeed. All right. Barry, Ohio, I guess. You're on the air.
Hey, can you hear me?
Yes,
hello.
Hi.
Hello.
Ohio, yeah. No, oh, hi, Neil, Art, this is legendary. Okay, I remember watching an episode of Cosmos that you did a while ago, and you talked about Venus, how it's very similar to Earth, and how, like, if all the volcanoes went off and everything, like, if we exhaust all our resources, Earth would be a lot like Venus. And it really kind of shifted my paradigm a bit, and I'm hearing all this talk about Mars and, you know, how there's life on Mars. And I guess my question is could maybe Mars not have had, like, old life on it, but maybe Venus did?
Well, I haven't heard about life on Mars, really.
These are good questions. So Venus, you know, is kind of a hopeless cause today. I mean, it's 900 degrees Fahrenheit. And I did the calculation where you can cook a 16-inch pizza on the windowsill in 9 seconds. And then someone geekier than I was said, no, you did the calculation wrong. You left out the radiative effects of the atmosphere, and in fact, it will cook in 2 seconds. So so I got schooled on that one. So it's a 2-second pizza instead of a 9-second pizza. So an interesting question is, on Venus before it had this runaway greenhouse effect,
mm-hmm,
or on Mars,
yes,
back when we know it had once had running water, could there be evidence of civilizations that have come and gone? And that's an unknown question. I mean, it's a perfectly legitimate question that has no known answer at this point. And will require, look at what we're discovering even on Earth, but it requires major excavations. We didn't know about Pompeii until, what was it, 18, whatever? Pompeii is a modern discovery, yet that thing was around 2,000 years ago. And that's on our own Earth. So it's intriguing to imagine that these are dead planets of lost civilizations, but it will take much more of a space program than we currently have in order to investigate that.
Caller?
Cool. Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you very much. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You're very welcome. Take care. Since you mentioned greenhouse stuff, I guess it's worth asking, runaway greenhouse, is that possible here on Earth, in your opinion?
So when I first looked at this problem, it turns out I overestimated I was thinking that if we were not careful, we could become Venus.
Right.
Because we're flanked by two planets that have gone something's gone wrong. Something's gone bad. Venus with the runaway greenhouse effect, Mars once having water, now it doesn't, and we're sitting exactly in between them. Which way are we going to head?
Right.
And so, but when I spoke with some colleagues of mine, and then I came to realize that if you burned all the coal and all the gas and all the sequestered carbon for fuel that is there, that we were already pulling out of the ground, we will not have a runaway greenhouse effect like Venus. What we'll have is an Earth with no ice caps and a very different coastline, and all of the greatest cities of the world will be completely flooded. But we will not have a runaway greenhouse, because you just have to go back to a time when there was no buried carbon. And we did have high carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere. And it's called the Carboniferous period on Earth, where there was heavy growth of plants and trees. And the trees didn't have anything to have them decompose. So because bacteria had not gotten savvy enough yet to figure out how to digest the was it the lignin or one of the molecules in the tree that made it strong. So the trees grow and they die, they fall over and they do not decompose. And so the world is accumulating this layer of vegetation that is not decomposing, and that would ultimately become the oil reserves. So there was a time when the dinosaurs were around, there was no ice anywhere in the world. And they had much less land because of that fact.
Well, what about our submerged? Yeah, what about our submerged cities, Doctor? And the fact that any good growing would move from the central part of the U.S. way up in north into Canada somewhere.
Yeah, exactly. I think you could probably move farms fast enough to keep up with this change, to where it was previously not arable, now it is, and maybe it was and now is not. You could do that, because what are you moving? You're just, you know, planting your seeds in a different place. The hard part would be the cities and all the people whose entire lives, you know, when you flood the coastlines, rich people lose their second home and poor people lose their only home.
Right.
You look at how many poor people live in poor countries on the coast, because that's where transportation or commerce or whatever else is conducted. So we're now making that happen at a rate faster than we could possibly respond, given the locations of the major cities in the world, which historically have always been on the river's edge or on the ocean edge.
That's right. All right, very quickly, we don't have a lot of time. Chelsea, hi. You're on with Dr. Tyson.
Hello. I'd like to know what the nature of the edge of the universe is, if there is an edge.
Yeah, that's a great question. So there's a little bit of confusion about that, so let me just straighten that out right now. We have what we speak of as the edge of the universe, but it's not an actual edge any more than your horizon at sea is an edge. It's a horizon. It's a visible horizon beyond which we cannot see. All right, and that's this, you know, when you look out, that's where the cosmic microwave background emanates from. And we have no reason to think that the universe doesn't continue well beyond that horizon, for the same reasons that the ocean continues beyond your horizon when you're on a ship at sea. And this analogy is very potent for this case. So the question is, how much bigger than our horizon must the universe be? And there are people who have estimated this based on some plausible arguments. And forgive me, but I forgot the number. But maybe factors of tens larger, or possibly infinite. But we know it's bigger than our horizon. And so in that sense, there's no edge where you get to the edge and fall off. especially if the actual universe is infinite. But our visible edge, that's just there like any horizon at sea that you'd have if you viewed it from a ship's masthead.
Cool. Thanks.
All right. Thank you, Chelsea, and take care. Let's go outside the country to Carl. Hi.
Oh, hi. I just wanted to ask Dr. Tyson where exactly the expansion of the universe takes place. I understand that we see it through Doppler shift of distant galaxies and whatnot, but I just wanted to know if where exactly it takes place.
Okay, Carl, where are you, please?
I'm in Hungary.
Hungary, okay.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Thanks for calling in from abroad. So we're stuck in a paradigm of mind where when an event happens, you can go point, oh, it happened right there, right? But we're less, in our minds, we don't think of events happening at a time in a coordinate, right? So the Big Bang happened everywhere 13.7, 13.8 billion years ago. So I can point to it, but I'm pointing backwards on the timeline to show you when it happened. And the when is no less legitimate than where when I'm localizing things in space and time for you. So everything you see participated in that expansion and continues to do so. And if we drop one of the dimensions of this analogy to perhaps shine a little better light on it, and you've probably heard this example before, you think of an expanding balloon. So now all of space is now the surface of a balloon. The surface is expanding if you inflate the balloon.
Right.
And you say, well, where is the center of this expansion? Where is it coming from? It's not on the surface of the balloon anymore. It is back through time. So you have to look in the time dimension back when the balloon was smaller. And then you can point to that exact moment in space and in time when the universe began.
Okay. Very quickly to the phones. Yeah. You're on there. Hi. Hello.
Hello.
Yes. Hello. Go ahead. Caller, you're on the air. Going once, going twice, gone to Manitoba. Hello in Manitoba.
Okay. Hello, Art. Thank you so much for taking my call. And hello, Dr. Tyson.
Yeah, hello.
I just actually wanted to ask if time travel would be possible, should we say... master the, I guess, energy output problem.
So it turns out that if we had the power over the fabric of space and time enough to build wormholes, then there are trajectories around and through wormholes where you can come out in a different time from when you left, like in your past. And this is kind of scary because let's say you did that and then you prevented yourself from building the wormhole to travel back in time to see your past.
Paradox.
You wouldn't have you have a time paradox. And so there's some people, I think Stephen Hawking included, who are thinking that though we have not discovered it yet, that eventually we will find a fundamental law of physics that prevents backward time travel just so that we don't suffer from that paradox.
All right.
But we're not there yet.
All right, Doctor. Hold on. We have one last segment. Sit tight.
All right.
It's the long break, and try to be there if you can when we get back.
Dark Matter Network News. This is Amy Martin. For the week of Halloween, The Star has published a laundry list of various incidents reported by UK authorities about UFO and extraterrestrial calls to 999 emergency services. The list includes calls about alleged alien threats over Wi-Fi signals, aliens offering meat to locals, and extraterrestrial house guests that just won't go away. While authorities are bemused by pranks which interrupt emergency services, they point out, there are, however, certain examples where people have reported noises at a property and they believe it to be ghostly or extraterrestrial-related activity. Officers must still respond to ensure that a burglary or other form of crime is not being committed. See this list of strange reports for yourself over on thestar.co.uk. Officials say a Portland man has been arrested for breaking into a neighbor's home and stealing women's underwear. The 24-year-old reportedly told police he had thought about breaking into a neighbor's home many times just to see if he could get away with it. The couple living there has chased him out and called the police. He was booked on burglary and criminal mischief charges. Astronomers have located a previously unknown component of the Milky Way galaxy. By mapping out the locations of a class of stars that vary in brightness called Cepheids, a disk of young stars buried beneath the thick dust clouds in the central bulge has been found. The ages of these classical Cepheids provide solid evidence that there has been a previously unconfirmed continuous supply of newly formed stars in the central region of the Milky Way over the last 100 million years. But this wasn't the only remarkable discovery from the survey. Mapping the Cepheids, the team traced an entirely new feature in the Milky Way, a thin disk of young stars across the galactic bulge. This component to our home galaxy has remained unknown and invisible to previous surveys, as it was buried behind thick clouds of dust. A couple has claimed that they have encountered a giant beaver in northern Minnesota. The man says that he and his wife were in the wilderness of the region between the United States and Canada when they spotted the animal in 2007. He told Cryptozoology News, "We did not tell anyone because we did not think anyone would believe us." The man, who claims to be a UC Berkeley graduate, says that he has a degree in the biological sciences and that he is, quote, very familiar with North American mammals. The creature, he explains, was approximately 5 to 6 feet long, not including the tail, and thought to be a giant beaver that went extinct around 10,000 years ago. So far, no evidence of the beaver has emerged, and no word yet on this interesting observation reported in any peer-reviewed sources. This has been Amy Martin for Dark Matter Network News.
Yes.
Okay, it concerns a wormhole. Now, I watched Jodie Foster in a wormhole. If we were,
evidence,
yeah, that's right. No, no, that's not the question. If we were actually able to transit in a wormhole, do you have any imagination that tells you what it might be like?
No, I don't. And you know, I just go with how wormholes are traditionally portrayed as this sort of vortex through the fabric of space and time. I think if the folks back in the year 1968, when they made the film 2001, that if they had a sort of deeper sense of the vorticity of a wormhole, that they might have shown those psychedelic scenes a little differently. Because as they were, you would look like you were moving through parallel sheets. And they might have made it sort of more circular, more cylindrical. But No, I have no idea whatsoever. I'm wondering if you wouldn't feel the journey through the wormhole. You just sort of step through this portal and come out the other side, and bada bing, you're there.
Right.
And because that's what it's doing. It's you know what it's like? It's like the doors in Monsters, Inc. Those are wormholes, right?
Mm-hmm,
they take from a door manufactured in the factory, and they open the door, the monster, and they show up in the child's closet, ready to terrorize them. There's no journey that they take.
That's true.
Because the door is the same door.
Right.
And so that maybe that's really what it's like. It would be less cinematic, though, if they portrayed it.
Doctor, are you the one who coined the phrase death by black hole?
Well, that's the title of one of my books, which the best-selling of my books is Death by Black Hole. And it's still out there. I'm flattered because there's a lot of energy that I put into its contents and it's how I communicate, and it's called The Death by Black Hole and Other Cosmic Quandaries. So yeah, that is the title of one of my books.
Okay. All right, Roxanne.
I want to die. That's how I want to die. I want to send me into a black hole. That's
be
way
quick
funner
anyway.
Than hit by a bus.
Roxanne, hello.
Hi. I am also want to plug Art Bell Time Travelers on Facebook. And I want to thank you very much for having Dr. Tyson on.
You're very welcome. Time Travelers is merely a little club we have that allows you to listen to every program we do. You know, that's thank you, Roxanne.
Oh, cool, cool.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Anyway, I do have a
question. The elite few, that
wanted,
is.
That's right.
Well, okay. Mm-hmm. I do have a question I wanted to ask you for many years, actually. Have you ever seen a UFO, a ship, and knew that it wasn't from the Air Force or anyone?
So I've seen, as is true with most astronomers, particularly those who began as amateur astronomers, as I did.
Yes.
And amateur used in that context is actually a badge of honor. Amateur astronomers know the night sky better than any other people on Earth. And so you would never go to an amateur neurosurgeon, right? But if you went to an amateur astronomer, you can guarantee that they'll give you a tour of the night sky. In that capacity, where I'm looking up every night, and I know the sky like the back of my hand, enough to tell Jim Cameron that his sky was wrong just on a glance above the sinking Titanic. So that's not special talent. That's a talent that any astronomer would have who was an amateur astronomer.
Okay, spill it. What do you see?
Well, so not only that, so now I also know weather phenomena because I'm looking up and I'm trying to get the weather the hell out of the way so I can see the stars.
Swamp,
so
yes.
I have seen things that would have stumped me if I didn't have the body of knowledge that I do about what is possible to be seen in the night sky. And so I have never seen anything that I did not fully understand in the context of either weather phenomenon or astronomical phenomenon.
Okay.
That's your answer, Roxanne.
Okay. Hey, thank you very much. You are very interesting, and I love the way Art can sit back and listen, and we can all listen and enjoy a guest for a change.
That's what it's all about. Thank you.
Okay, excellent. Thanks.
Okay. I had the experience of seeing something that, Doctor, I guess I can't help myself. On the way home from Vegas one night, in a car with my wife, after working a show in Vegas, and my wife said, "What the hell's that?" I said, "What do you mean? Something behind us." All right. We get out of the car. Real quick story. We look up. Here comes behind us this, at about 150 feet, this giant triangular craft, looked very metallic. Very quiet here in the desert. You could hear crickets a quarter of a mile away. This thing passed directly over our heads, continued out toward, by the way, Area 51, which is just adjacent to us here, and was defying gravity, was not flying, not aerodynamic flight. So it was either lighter than air or defying gravity, one of the two, and it was gigantic. The moon, the stars went away, you know, the classic stuff. I saw that. If you were to see something like that, how would your mind, being a scientist, digest it?
Okay. I'm guessing that this was at night.
It was.
And most of these kinds of sightings happen at night where you've lost all sense of relative scale.
Yes, sir.
Because now it's just there in the darkness.
Not all sense of scale. I mean, we had the moon and we had the stars to go by.
No. My point is, if this is an object that you've never seen before,
right,
and there's nothing else adjacent to it that is familiar to you,
right,
then to assess its size becomes essentially impossible. You saw surely yesterday the images of the military blimp. Okay.
Yes.
So if you just see the blimp in the sky, in those images, you have no idea how big that is.
True.
Is it a half a mile across? Is it a toy blimp? Until you came near the trees, until it's something behind it and something in front of it. So it makes judging the size very difficult. So at night, the things you can't see, and that's why so many such sightings were reported at night rather than in the daytime.
Okay.
So I generally have binoculars with me at all times. I pull out my binoculars and try to find out what it is. And if I don't know what it, if I can't figure out what it is, I say, oh, it's a mystery.
Okay.
Or they're doing something cool over in Area 51.
That's my guess. This thing was about 150 feet above me. I'm telling you, Professor, it was close. And get this as a follow-up. About a week later, the local newspaper made an inquiry of the Air Force Base, Nellis. Nellis reported back in the newspaper, oh, yes, there was a secret mission at about that time that flew over the Pahrump Valley. It was a C-130 aircraft. I was in the Air Force, Professor, and I flew in
C-130.
I guarantee you, it would have rattled my teeth at that altitude.
Yeah, you can't mistake a C-130, but it could have been a drone, for example. Drones are pretty silent, and they would move exactly as you're describing. You're saying defying gravity, therefore it must have been lighter than air. No, it could have had propellers, you know, silent plastic propellers, like a drone.
Could have.
So, binoculars help because they not only help you see things close up, they also detect much more light than your human eye does.
Yeah.
So you can see other textures and things that would otherwise go unnoticed by your unaided eye. So carry binoculars with you. So next time that happens.
Oh, it would have been nice. Binoculars and a camera, whatever.
Big net. Yeah, to take a big net and capture it. That'll be way better than your eyewitness testimony of what you saw.
All right. Simon, outside the country somewhere, you're on the air.
Hi, Art Bell.
Hi.
Huge fan of Neil deGrasse, too. The multiverse as a comic book fan I'm already familiar with it. I was wondering if I would ever be able to meet my doppelganger out there.
Yes. Yeah, so what you're implying there is that given the multiverse, there would be countless other universes in every possible combination of atoms and events and probabilities, and so there's surely one with one that has one a person just like you out there, or maybe exactly you. And it's an intriguing thought. I have my skepticism of how large these infinities are. It turns out they're hierarchies of infinities. Some infinities are larger than others. And I plan to do some calculations on this to confirm for myself how big that infinity is. Because if it's not a big enough infinity, we're not going to get you. We'll just get sort of other universes. And the variations in all those universes will not be enough to find a universe that will make someone just like you. Well, it's much more likely that you'll find someone else who looks like you on Earth. So why don't you start there? Be happy with that.
Yeah.
Because the multiverse you is a long time coming.
Okay, Simon, thanks for the question. Where are you, by the way?
Toronto, Canada.
Toronto. Okay. You're not actually supposed to be on that line. I should have asked. Binghamton, New York on the phone. Hi.
Hey. All right. So you guys know the parallel planetary theory?
No.
Right?
I don't think so.
Parallel.
I mean, theoretically, if you met yourself in another universe or whatever, if you could take a spaceship and you flipped a coin, like, you know, I'm sorry, my phone or the thing's going off.
Are you talking about parallel universes, caller? Not parallel planets, right?
Yeah, parallel universe theory.
Oh, okay. Okay. So go on. Yes.
If you flipped a coin, if you met yourself, you know, if you could fly to another parallel universe and you flipped a coin, like, what would it land at?
Well, we have to be careful about other universes because the same concepts that lead to the prediction of other universes also prescribe that they have slightly different laws of physics operating within them. So you can bring a coin, but does the coin remain a coin in that other universe? Does the, you know, you just don't, does the structure of matter, is metal metal in that universe? You don't know. And so what I would do with the coin is flick it from my universe into that universe and see what happens to it. And then if it survives that trip, then maybe I'll dip my toe in and then go meet myself.
Well, maybe you just flip that coin into an antimatter universe.
Oh, that as well. You always got to carry some. If an alien lands, don't shake its hand until you toss it a coin. If the alien spontaneously annihilates, then you say, that was an antimatter alien. They probably would have annihilated by coming in contact with Earth's atmospheric molecules to begin with. But this is what led to the idea that the Tunguska explosion might have been an antimatter a chunk that exploded in midair, but you don't need antimatter to make that explosion. An ordinary asteroid or comet will do. So you want to make sure they're not antimatter. That would be a bad situation.
Certainly would. You'd have to apologize. Of course, there'd be nobody left to apologize to.
And by the way, there was an idea a few years ago that all the antimatter that should have been in our universe funneled out to make its own universe. And so you have creatures and planets and stars that are all made of antimatter, and it's regular matter that's exotic to them. And
wow.
Yeah. So
that's something to think about.
That's an out there idea.
Yeah, it is. Michael, wherever you are on Skype, hi.
Hi, Art, and great show tonight, guys.
Thank you.
I have a couple questions.
Go.
One is, I'm wondering if your guest knows what these small lights that everyone sees in the night sky, they look kind of like stars, but they're moving way too high for a plane, sometimes changing direction. A lot of people I know have seen these.
Well, sure, until you got changing direction, I would have said satellites, but changing direction is a problem.
But don't satellites just, like, orbit with the Earth? Wouldn't they just move along with...
Steadily along.
Change directions. No, Art is right. A satellite is a ballistic trajectory in orbit around the Earth. The satellites have no rocket control or anything. They're just orbit. An orbit is a stable thing that requires no fuel to maintain, unless you're very low and your atmosphere is eating up your energy and you have to boost yourself back up.
Right.
But otherwise, no. If it's changing direction, it's definitely not a satellite. It's something else, and who knows what it is. And by the way, I'm perfectly content looking up and saying, "Gee, I don't know what that is," and then try to figure out a way to figure it out. And that's a healthy posture. It's very different to say, "I don't know what that is," therefore it's intelligent aliens visiting us from another planet. If you don't know what it is, there is no therefore that follows that sentence.
Well, Doctor,
exactly. I don't know what it is.
Right. Do you have another question, caller?
Yes. Could the human body act as a capacitor, absorbing electricity and then discharging it just like the Dark Lord in Star Wars?
No, so here's the problem. We're not good at holding electricity the way a capacitor is designed to do. We're very good at transmitting electricity. So that's why when you rub your feet on the wool carpet, mm-hmm. bada bing, it comes right out to the doorknob. You would have to need an insulating layer that you can release, and then the electricity comes out of you, and then you can aim it at whoever is your target. But you would need a system of insulators that can de-insulate you on command. Then you could walk around with stored electricity, for sure. But one other thing about the lights, what you should do, as I said earlier in this a few minutes ago, carry binoculars with you. Do further experiments on this and see if it happens in the daytime. We have a better view of it. This is the investigation that any good scientist will do when they confront something they have never seen before or don't understand.
Professor, if you saw something that was so indisputably impossibly from Earth, would you go home and think about it before you made a public statement?
No, I would try to get data on it. I would get video cameras. I would get sound recorders. I would try to observe it in different wavelengths of light.
I would
get as much data as I possibly could. Then I would say, here's something I saw last night, and here's the data on it. And I would publish that, for sure.
Well, that would be great if you had all those things handy. But, a lot of times when you see these things, A, you're in shock, and B, nothing's handy.
No, I will so not be in shock. I'm trained to study that which I do not understand. That's what I do. I live my whole life doing that. And so I would get as much data as I could. If I could get no data on it, it would be an interesting cocktail party discussion. But there's nothing to go public on because I have no way to confirm for people what I saw other than eyewitness testimony. And in the court of science, that is the lowest form of evidence there is, which is odd because in the court of law, it's one of the highest forms of evidence there is.
And it's also why we have innocent people on death row.
Precisely because of the failure of eyewitness testimony.
There you have it.
And we know this. Psychologists know it. We've known it in science forever. And so even for lesser things than visiting aliens, do we not use each other's eyewitness testimony?
You know what? We're done. The show is over. There's nothing I can do about it. We could go on and on. Well, you're way back in the East Coast, right?
I am. Yeah, 3 in the morning here. But that's fine. It's just the night.
Thank you so much. It's been an honor having you on the show. Star Talk.
Thanks. And the questions were great. And thanks for fixing that Star Talk began October 25th when it goes every week for 10 weeks. Yeah.
Okay. All right.
People will think you went back in time. You see, you got to watch out for that. You're time traveling.
I'm constantly watching out for that. Thank you, Doctor.
Yeah. Okay. Great.
Good night, my friend. Bye-bye. Wow. That was something. That was really something. Truly an honor. Very, very, very bright man. And by the way, I never mention it. We do have something called the Time Travelers. Cute name for the ability for you to listen to any program we've got anytime. Just RSS feed it down and listen. That, and of course, the ability to send wormhole messages during shows like this. So, check into it. I keep forgetting to mention our Time Traveler group. Just go to artbell.com. It's that easy. You can learn all about it. From the high desert to all those time zones out there. Kind of a time travel, right? Good night.
Midnight in the desert. and there's wisdom in the air. I've been looking for the answers. All my life I felt you there. As the world we live in quickens, are we heeding all the signs? Have we lost our intuition? Are we running out of time? Midnight in the desert, and we're listening. Ooh, we're listening. And we're listening. Ooh, we're listening.
Tomorrow night, Dead Air.